This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. With Duke Energy in our midst, North Carolina is home to the largest electric utility in the country. But our state is also a leader in renewable energy, and Duke plays a role in that as well. The Tar Heel State ranks third in the nation for installed solar capacity and will soon boast the first utility-scale wind farm in the Southeast. But there are some challenges to these ventures into renewable energy sources. For instance, experts say our state has tremendous geographic advantages when it comes to generating electric power from the wind. Yet a bill passed in the state Senate this year that would have banned wind farms in certain areas of the state. That bill died, but could come back again next year. But state tax credits that helped our solar industry grow so quickly expired last year, and some worry that might put a serious damper on future growth. So what is the state of renewable energy in North Carolina? We talk about that with some experts this hour. George Brown is General Manager of Distributed Energy Resources Strategy at Duke Energy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Joel Olson is CEO of O2 EMC and President of O2 Energies, a solar power company based in Cornelius, which develops, owns, and operates more than 100 megawatts of solar farms across the Southeast. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I get all confused when we start talking about megawatts. Dustin Chickerell-Baird is Communications Director for the North Carolina Sierra Club. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by David Borax, WFAE's Energy and Environment Reporter. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Mike.
How did North Carolina come to be third in the nation in terms of installed solar capacity, David?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. First of all, this is a great place to do solar. I read the other day that North Carolina has twice the solar potential of Germany, which is another leader in the solar industry. I think we have like 250 days a year of sun on average, depending on how you measure it. So it is a great place to do solar. It may also be a great place to do wind, although in our state, solar power has been the main choice. The other reason is that in 2007, the legislature passed a law which basically put into place incentives for and requirements for utility companies to adopt renewable energy. And we're talking about solar, wind, and also biofuels or biomass, which is generating fuels from plant matter or hog waste, for that example.
Which Duke is now doing.
So, and that requires the companies, in the case of large utilities like Duke, they have to get up to about 12.5% of their portfolio has to be generated from renewable sources.
The General Assembly set these figures, I think, in 2007, to buy 3% of renewable energy by 2012, 6% by 2015, 10% by 2018, and 12.5% by 2021. That sounds fairly progressive, is it?
It is. I mean, other states have adopted even more progressive laws, and they've done other things that would open up renewable energy to a wider market. In North Carolina, one of the things that we've done is we've said we want the utilities to drive this. The legislature has set up the laws in a way that limits what individuals can do, like on your house or small groups, but it does...
But wait, you used utilities.
Yes.
Isn't there only one?
Actually, people who live in the Charlotte area know that our utility is Duke Energy. If you live in other places, you might have a locally owned utility, an energy membership corporation. There are other utilities out there.
And, Mike, Duke Energy actually owns two utilities in North Carolina. One is Duke Energy Carolinas, which serves the Charlotte area, and the other one is Duke Energy Progress, which is – formerly known as Progress Energy Carolinas.
You haven't combined the two.
They're
two discrete companies. Is the plan to combine them?
I think eventually the plan is to combine them.
Do they operate fairly similarly in terms of what you're doing to generate power and in terms of the rates that you set?
Yes, we do operate the system jointly together to dispatch our units as efficiently as we can across the two utilities. Our rates are separate and distinct.
These solar arrays that we have cropping up around the state, are they owned mostly by Duke Energy, or are you simply buying power from independent companies like O2 EMC?
Most of the solar, the utility scale solar, is owned by other companies besides Duke Energy. We own, between our regulated business and our unregulated business, or will own, roughly 400 megawatts. In our two utilities in the Carolinas, we purchase probably an additional 1,100, let's say, megawatts from third-party developers, or will be there pretty soon. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the day-to-day things change because, you know, facilities come online.
And why have you chosen to do it that way, given the fact that, well, we'll talk about the economics of solar and wind, et cetera, but why has Duke, which is a utility producing, an electricity producing and distribution company, why have you chosen to buy it as opposed to building your own arrays?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with how the state has implemented policy. We mentioned the renewable portfolio standard earlier, but there's another policy, which is known as PURPA, which requires us to have rates for non-utility generators. And in North Carolina, those rates for non-utility solar generators are very attractive. And that's been a driver of a lot of the solar.
Is Joel, is that why Joel is Joel Olson is the CEO of O2 EMC and O2 Energies? He's the president of that company. Is that what has driven solar investors to flock to North Carolina?
Well, it's a number of things. I think what David said first, you know, we had a bipartisan bill that basically put certain requirements that all utilities, you know, Duke and Progress, of course, Energy United is our third largest utility, Dominion, the rest of the co-ops and electricities around the state, all signed on to a bill that was a really good compromise in 2007. And that was the foundation. But, you know, I do have to give a lot of credit to Duke in that there's a lot of utilities around the country that just fought and fought and fought mm-hmm. any sort of penetration into their monopoly utility space to generate power. Duke tried to find ways to work with us, independent power producers. And as George mentioned, PURPA, which was a federal law that was implemented in 1978 during the second fuel crisis, was really a way to allow independent power production in the United States. And it had kind of been forgotten until, you know, in combination with our state bipartisan bill and the fact that, you know, the utilities here have calculated the avoided cost of what it costs them to generate power pretty fairly. So when you combine that with the investment tax credit, back in 2010, O2 Energies was actually the first solar company that was able to use this PURPA avoided cost that utilities have to provide as their, you know, what would it cost them to generate their own kilowatt hour. When we were able to do that, the market really exploded. So we set the stage where we had a very efficient interconnection process. The North Carolina Utilities Commission had a standard. So instead of going into negotiation for every single interconnection, there was a set standard that as long as utility met that goal, they could use that standard. And that really, that efficiency reduced the amount of state resources right. and legal resources to get this done.
So that made it easier for your mass producers of solar energy, such as your company, to come in here. What about the state's 35% tax credit? Did that impact you, or is that more aimed at individual, like residential people who want to put it on their roof?
Well, let me say the state's investment tax credit served a very specific purpose. That was to get private investment in the utility infrastructure space. So that, you know, government can't do everything. They need to attract private investment. And that state investment tax credit was able to provide that incentive so that private capital came in. They would put these assets in place, but these assets pay state taxes for 35 years. So it's a net gain to the state to put these in place. And just for an example, last year there were about you know, the amount of revenue that was created for state and local governments from the solar industry was about over $500 million, and the cost in tax credits was only $200 million. So it was absolutely crucial to get things started. Now that it's gone, though, the large-scale utility producers can continue, but these small residential and these hog waste producers of electricity, they are absolutely struggling to stay alive.
Hmm. Talk to me about why, David, the 35% tax credit for alternative energy sources was allowed to expire. And it expired, I think, December 31st.
Well, there's been a change in the political climate in North Carolina since the law was first passed, and I think that's probably the biggest thing. There are opponents in the legislature of renewable energy, and I'm not quite sure where they're coming from on that. I think some are friends of the large utilities. I think some have ideological reasons for opposing solar and wind. And so, you know, we've seen the legislature turn from a place where you could get a bill passed in 2007 to a place now where we see bills popping up every year that are trying to kind of pare back the industry.
So some lawmakers claim that consumers were paying higher rates to subsidize power companies because of this 35% tax credit. Dustin, you're with the Sierra Club. Environmentalists, I'm told, claim that utilities are waging a campaign to prevent small operators from impinging on potential revenues. What is the story here, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, David's absolutely right. The climate was way different when the renewable energy portfolio standard passed. And there is a small rider on people's utility bills to help pay for the electricity that is generated from renewable resources. You know, what's different now is we are seeing many challenges to the gains that we made that took decades to put in place. And I believe the renewable energy portfolio standard, Senate Bill 3, passed nearly unanimously, if not unanimously at the time. There definitely is a change in political climate. Fortunately, as Joel can attest, clean energy is now big business in the state. It's not the hobby shop,
right?
Build it in your garage. It's not your father's solar anymore. We're talking about large-scale farms, and anything that is 5 megawatts or less is one of those qualifying facilities where the utility must purchase it. So that's been beneficial, moving us towards the clean energy that we need.
This renewable energy portfolio standard, which you mentioned just a second ago, which is that mandate that by certain years, a certain percentage of electric power has to come from renewable sources. We were the first state in the nation to pass that. Are we backing away from that now? Do you see that as do you see us backing away, or is it just set through 2021?
So we were the first state in the Southeast, and we're still the only state in the Southeast that has the mandate to provide a certain amount of our energy from clean resources. I don't know it's so much that we're backing away. There are efforts in the legislature and just throughout the political climate in general to move us away from that. I think the real problem is that we're not being as innovative as we were. We're not pushing forward. And those things that made us a leader in the Southeast, we don't have that drive that we had.
What are the political forces working against something that seems to be a no-brainer to me, and that is not polluting the atmosphere because you're using solar, you're using wind, and also it's become big business. It's good for business. And there is, and we'll talk about this, a consumer demand for this. Why are the political forces working in opposition to this, apparently?
I think it's partly ideological. People,
based on what?
It's a little hard to understand that. I'm not sure I can answer that question. But, I mean, Dustin, you're at the legislature. You see folks coming in and lobbying. What are you hearing from the other side?
You know, it's difficult because sometimes the legislature can be devoid of facts, you know, and so and that's just a problem. So, you know, when there is talk about, you know, the ideological motivation to get rid of subsidies or incentives, that's often disproportionately applied to clean energy, but not applied to other energy sources. So, you know, it's not really a level playing field. And I think the Senate Bill 3 that we have and the incentives that we had on the books were intended to create a more level playing field, to make things more balanced. And sadly, that's kind of backing away.
Mike, one thing I would say is that I think it's true. I think that there are, you know, elements of the legislature who are not supporters of renewable energy, but there are also elements of the legislature who are supporters of renewable energy. And so I think it's kind of a mixed situation.
Well, one of our listeners, Chris, has emailed us. He is obviously not a supporter of the subsidies, and we'll read his email and get your reaction to that when we come back. And we'll talk about why there is a public demand and how big this public demand happens to be for alternative sources of energy for generating electric power when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, formerly Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, a full-service law firm serving business litigation needs locally and across the nation. The name has changed, but dedication to serving clients and communities remains. Bradley.com. The use of social media has been exploding. Nearly two-thirds of Americans are now on a social networking site, using those sites for a lot of different reasons, including an opportunity to get things off their chests. It's a bedrock of free speech, but one that presents a challenge to some employers. What happens when your opinion doesn't toe the company line? Some employers are trying to set boundaries, but does that mesh with the First Amendment? We get some legal opinions on that on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, leaders of the NATO military alliance convene in Warsaw. President Obama announces the U.S. will slow the pace of American troop withdrawal in Afghanistan, and Britain is on track to elect the first female prime minister since Margaret Thatcher.
Join the Diane Rehm Show ahead from 10 to noon on listener-supported public radio 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about alternative energy sources in North Carolina with George Brown, General Manager of Distributed Energy Resources Strategy at Duke Energy, Joel Olson, CEO of O2EMC and President of O2 Energies, Dustin Chickerell-Bayard is Communications Director of the North Carolina Sierra Club, and David Borax is our Energy and Environment Reporter here at WFAE. Chris emails, why should the taxpayers subsidize big solar? I am pro-solar, and the price per kilowatt hour of solar is dropping rapidly. It will be viable on its own without an incentive before long. Why should the taxpayer subsidize big solar and the middle and upper class who can afford to install solar? Good question. And I'm sure that's what's reverberating around the legislature. Why?
Well, I can take a stab, Mike. I agree that the price of solar is coming down dramatically, and I think that's been a big driver for the solar. I mean, in North Carolina, is that it is much cheaper than it used to be. I think it's fair to ask the question why a subsidy. We don't have an inherent issue with any subsidy as long as it's sort of, you know, neutral and sort of technology agnostic. So I think that's really just more of a general policy.
Well, in 2007, when the subsidy was established, requiring that you have 3% of your energy generated by renewable sources, and now it's, 6% by 2015, 10% by 2018, 12.5% by 2021. Was it necessary to kickstart this to have these incentives?
You know, I think it absolutely was, and I like to think of it more as an incentive, right? We need an incentive for private capital in public infrastructure. You know, everybody uses the electrical grid. It is crucial that it works and that it's reliable. And it's crucial, I think, that we are generating those jobs and those investments in North Carolina and not buying cheap, dirty fuel from someplace else. So the fact that this investment tax credit works so well to the point where we were able to let it expire for the largest solar is just a huge win for the state, and especially if we can keep this industry continuing to grow.
You mentioned something during the break, because we've all been sitting here patting ourselves on the back about our being number one in the Southeast for having this renewable energy portfolio standard. But we're 16th. Help me put this into perspective. 30th in the country. Is that right? Give me the figures you gave me during the break
again. Right. So, you know, these renewable energy requirements or clean energy requirements that utilities on a state level are required to comply with, we were about 30th in the country to impose these standards on utilities.
Right.
If we look at Hawaii, they have 100% renewable energy requirement by 2025 or something. If we look at California, they've recently implemented 50%. Walmart themselves, because it saves money, has said they want to be 100% clean energy supplied in all their operations, I believe, by 2020. So it's something.
And how
that makes
can they achieve that?
Sense.
Aren't they at the mercy of the power companies in the states in which they operate?
Walmart, you mentioned the wind farm.
Right.
You know, Amazon is buying all the electricity that's going to be generated by that new wind farm near Elizabeth City in North Carolina. Walmart's buying power from solar facilities, from wind facilities, left and right, because it makes financial sense.
Hmm. According to Reuters, George Brown, the cost of electricity from large-scale solar installations is now comparable to and sometimes cheaper than natural gas-fired power without the incentives. Does that make upgrading the substations? There are substations evidently in rural areas that cannot handle the additional solar power coming
Correct.
Into them,
right.
Which is partially putting a damper on this. Does that not justify, then, upgrading those substations so that they can handle that power?
Well, I think it may. I doubt very much that Reuters would have detailed data to be able to look at it at a substation-by-substation level. And you really have to look at it that way to determine whether or not the capital upgrade necessary for that incremental solar facility is indeed, when you wrap that into the cost of the solar facility, whether that indeed is competitive with natural gas.
Because there are growing pains in all of this, and people have talked about our state nearing a tipping point with regard to renewable energy, a peak. They say that our tremendous progress is facing a land shortage, economic roadblocks, and the fact that these rural substations, David, cannot handle the extra capacity required to take in the power and then distribute it out. How much of that is accurate, do you think?
Well, you know, we're building a new industry here since 2007. And just back to what we were talking about a minute ago, that law created an environment, it created incentives, it set up the structure under which we could get private investors coming in, the utility would be working with them. You know, it's a process to develop this industry. It's also a process for the utility to figure out what equipment to use and how it works together, how it fits in with the current grid. I had a chance to visit recently in South Charlotte. There's a Duke Energy calls it its microgrid, a McAlpine microgrid. It's right next to the fire station off of Ray Road. And that is a little test bed for how the solar works with battery storage and how it interconnects with the network. And this small facility can supply emergency power for that fire station when the power goes down. But it's a real test bed. They're testing batteries. They're testing different ways of interconnecting. You know, they're figuring out how it works when there's an actual emergency. And, you know, all of that takes time to develop. And so that's, what, 9 years ago? And we're working towards it. I think, you know, the climate here has been and the incentives have been in place to get it to a point where we can keep working on it. But, you know, some of these little things, like I don't know if there's a land shortage. I don't know. You know, there may be some opponents in certain areas where developers want to build solar, but we have plenty of land here for solar or wind. And I think that, you know, the utility does face some challenges that are technical in nature, but they've kept power flowing to our houses for, you know, a century now. And yeah. We can expect them to continue working on the technical problems around this. So
I want to come back to the land problem in a second. But Joel, you say on the one hand that we have one of the most friendly utilities in the nation for clean energy, Duke Energy and Duke Progress. On the other hand, you say that as more clean energy is put onto the grid, we've seen increasing efforts from utilities to create additional requirements and costs to interconnect to the grid. What are you saying there? Are you saying that Duke Energy is friendly or was friendly to a point, but now they'd rather do it themselves because they don't want to pay the price that they have to pay to buy it from you?
Well, you have to remember, I mean, Duke Energy is a very large organization, and, you know, 10 years ago, those who were for solar were a very small group within the company. The number that really support clean energy in Duke is growing very, very fast. But there are still some that feel that it's better to just continue business as normal instead of making those kind of somewhat dramatic shifts. I mean, think about it. You know, if AT&T said, we don't want to use cell phones, we don't want to make the upgrades to use cell phones, they really wouldn't be competitive long term. And I think Duke has embraced it to this point, but I do think it is putting stress on some specific substations. Now, they've got 3,300 across the state, but there are some specific examples where, yeah, those specific substations might be getting a little bit full. I drove by the Campbell Soup Factory in Maxton yesterday, and there were several solar farms around it. But at the same time, you got to remember, when companies are looking to locate, look at Google, look at Apple. They want to have solar right beside their facilities. It is a fantastic economic development tool. In you know, the state's poorest county, in Scotland County, here, you know, we had a lot of traditional industry. Having those solar farms there, I think, are worth the upgrades that Duke would have to make to its system just in that one spot.
And just to jump in here, you know, it's a little bit different because we don't really have a free market for energy. We do have regulated monopolies and utilities. So there's nothing, you know, for Joel's example, if AT&T were becoming outdated, not innovating, a customer can switch to another carrier. As a homeowner, as a resident, you can't switch to another power company in your area. What we are seeing, though, is some of the electric membership cooperatives becoming more innovative, offering people choice and through community solar programs that allow them to get the energy in a way that fits with their values and helps them address and meet their energy needs responsibly.
And Duke Energy has been, I'm told, investing more money in alternative power generation sources, including the buying hog waste to generate gas for your natural gas burning plants. Is this push on the part of Duke Energy due to regulation? Is it due to market demand? Is it due to the fact that it makes good business sense?
I think it's a combination of factors, Mike. I think, number one, to Joel's point, I think an increasing number of our customers want us to procure renewable energy and generate it as well. I think, number two, the cost of the technology has come down dramatically, so it is much more cost competitive with other technologies. And I think the company's committed to increasing amounts of clean energy and carbon-free energy. I don't think there's any doubt about that across the company. That said, there is transition that has to take place, and that takes time. And, you know, we're working on that.
And the transition can be painful for some. Bill emails, my home county in southern Indiana, or in my home county in southern Indiana, the poorest county in the state. It sits on the largest deposit of coal east of the Mississippi. It's been a big part of the state's economy since it was first mined on a large scale in the early part of the 20th century. While I'm an advocate of clean energy, I'm concerned about the welfare of populations that are dependent on coal for their survival. What realistic options are there for these folks? Joel.
You know, last year there were about 60,000 people in the United States that worked in the coal industry. There were over 200,000 working in the solar industry. So,
can they learn those jobs? Would they be good candidates to learn those jobs?
Absolutely. What we're seeing in North Carolina, it's not just the universities and research and development, and you know companies like utility companies like Duke or O2 that are putting utility scale solar, but it's lawyers, it's construction workers, it's mechanical contractors.
But if you're in Indiana, I'm sure the sun doesn't shine as much as it does here in North Carolina.
We have a utility there, and you're right.
Okay, so if you're in Indiana and you've made your livelihood in the coal business and suddenly coal starts going away because utilities are shifting to alternative sources of energy or cleaner forms of energy, is it realistic to expect that you'll get a job in the solar industry in Indiana?
Mike, I would say that one of the big drivers for the reduction in coal, in addition to increased renewables, the biggest driver is actually the lower price of natural gas. And so natural gas is so inexpensive relative to its historical price to coal that it's putting a lot of pressure on coal producers.
Mm. Joel, you lived and worked in both Japan and Norway before your present position, where and in both those countries, evidently, solar power is a tremendous source of power. How far behind the curve are we when you look at Norway and Japan? Much smaller countries, obviously, but how far ahead of us are they, or how far behind are we?
Well, if you look at Europe, or specifically Germany in general, there was a day in May where 87% of their electricity total came from solar on one day. In North Carolina right now, we're at about 1.5% of the electricity consumed. George can confirm maybe 2% that's being consumed coming from solar. We've seen countries like Spain.
Is that because our demand is so much greater than it would be in those countries?
No, it's just that we're farther behind on the curve of implementation. And what's interesting, Mike, is we've got countries now that are almost 10% supplied just by solar with no storage at all. We're maybe five times behind those countries right now with no storage. The nice thing about where we are today in North Carolina is storage is also becoming cheaper. There's an estimated 17,000 jobs in North Carolina alone that could come from storage companies. Like, you know, we have Alivo and Concord, but, you know, we have the textile company that is here in Charlotte that makes the lithium-ion battery separator, CellGuard, and 84 other companies that when you combine solar and storage can take us well beyond that 10% with solar plus storage. So, you know, we've got a long way to go just on solar alone, but when we combine these technologies, I think we've got a great opportunity.
Duke Energy burns coal, natural gas. They generate electricity through hydro or water power. You're buying solar, you're buying wind, I think. You're generating electricity now by burning methane gas from hog waste.
And nuclear.
I forgot nuclear. So we will never be Nobody will ever be, I would think, 100% solar and or wind.
Right.
There will always be a combination. So this is just another tool in the toolkit, right?
In our view, it is. It's another tool in the toolkit. It's got a lot of good attributes to it. And as the cost continues to come down, I think we will expect to deploy more.
Can we be, do you see a day in the future when we will be fundamentally renewable-based energy production? We'll have fundamentally renewable-based energy production versus coal or gas or nuclear for that?
Well, I will take exception with one thing Joel said, that I think here in the Southeast, because of air conditioning, the penetration of air conditioning here is so much greater than in a place like Germany, that people use more electricity here per person. So the needs are a little different. So in terms of the percentages we're going to be able to achieve, I don't know that we're going to be able to get there. But that said, I don't think you're going to see a day where we won't have gas. We will have some gas at all times, I think, at all times.
Dustin, the figures that Joel gave us a little while ago about our being 30th in the country in terms of this mandate for solar power or renewable energy sources, that seems pretty behind the curve. And we started by saying we're ahead of the curve in North Carolina, but the whole Southeast is behind the curve. Why?
It is, and we've typically we've had low fuel costs, which have driven, and those have been predominantly because of coal. So while we're behind the curve as far as a mandate goes, how much we produce, we're second in the country last year for how much solar energy we actually brought online. It was over a gigawatt. We have over 2 gigawatts online right now, and that powers over 245,000 homes in the state. So while our mandate is less than other mandates are, the industry here is growing remarkably well. A lot of investment, so we have a lot of opportunity. And I think Joel is right. Storage is going to be the thing that takes us to the next level.
There is a concern about what all these new industries and technologies do to jobs that were set up in the early 20th century and have helped the American economy expand for 100 years or more. It takes a lot of people, I would think, to build a solar array or to erect a wind turbine. But once they're up and operating, particularly solar, I would think maintenance is relatively low and doesn't require a lot of people, as opposed to a coal-fired electricity-generating plant, which employs a lot of people. How many jobs are we going to see change or go away as more renewable energy comes online within the power industry itself?
That's hard to say exactly. I will say that the situation with coal and the number of employees that work on coal plants, that's going to transpire, or how that's going to change over time is going to evolve naturally as much to do with natural gas as with solar, I would say. And so I don't know that there's a direct correlation.
But doesn't it take people to run a natural gas plant?
It does, but
It
does, but it generally doesn't take as many as it does for a coal plant.
Okay.
So I don't think the environmental forces that are and the technological forces that are against coal are going to be abated by attacking renewables.
It's George Brown, who's the general manager of Distributed Energy Resources Strategy at Duke Energy. We're coming back to talk more about alternative sources of energy in North Carolina in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas. Blood donations historically decrease in the summer. Local businesses, churches, and organizations can host community blood drives to support local patients. CBCC.us. The latest on the investigations into the sniper attack on police in Dallas and the 2 fatal shootings by police of African-American men in Louisiana and Minnesota. Yeah, that's the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. She and her panel of guests talk about tensions over deadly police force against black Americans and the movement for justice and reform. That's the conversation coming up. If you'd like to join ours, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or get to us through Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
I have never, ever been a car person. I'm Alyssa Block, special correspondent with NPR. I never even had a car until I was into my 30s, and I always thought cars were just, you know, utilitarian things that get you from point A to point B. But driving a Mini, we have a Mini Cooper, is really, really fun. It gets looks, people stop and ask you about it, and it's just made me appreciate that driving can also be really fun. Imagine turning that car into my favorite programs.
Click on the support tab at WFAE.org to learn more.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about renewable energy in North Carolina and the state of it all with Joel Olson, the CEO of O2 EMC and the president of O2 Energies. They develop, own, and operate more than 100 megawatts of solar farms across the southeast. Dustin Chickerell-Bayard is communications director of the Sierra Club, an environmental organization. Joel Brown's with Duke Energy, and David Borax is our energy and environment reporter here at WFAE. You know, even if fossil fuel consumption wasn't a detriment to the environment, which obviously it has become, don't renewable energy sources simply make sense to those of you who generate electric power because of economics? I mean, once you spend the money to put up the array or the wind farm, it's pretty much free, isn't it?
It's very low cost after that initial capital investment. You're absolutely right. And we take that into account.
Why aren't you rushing toward this? Seriously. Seriously, coal costs money, gas costs money. Why aren't you rushing toward this?
Well, the thing to remember when we look at a go-forward decision, right, the coal plants have been invested in, have been paid for, largely paid for.
Yeah.
So there isn't much incremental investment necessary there, or very little incremental. So you're really just
Don't you have to buy the coal?
You have to buy the coal, but the coal—
You don't have to buy the sun.
But one of the reasons that there's been so much job loss in the coal industry is because the price of coal has been falling.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason the price of coal has been falling is it has to fall to be competitive with natural gas.
Okay.
So all the fuels have been falling. Just look at the gasoline you pay. Everything's been falling. As a result, that differential, that ability to avoid fuel isn't as great. That value avoidance isn't as great as it used to be when fuel prices were higher. That's something that actually works a little bit against renewables. So there's sort of been two technology changes. One has been the plummeting price of gas, and the other is the plummeting price of renewables. And they're kind of, in my mind, kind of battling it out to see where we end up.
We have fairly low electric rates in North Carolina, I'm told, in comparison to other parts of the country. But let me tell you, as a consumer, if somebody was going to tell me that I could get my electricity for free versus paying you guys every month, I would choose option A.
Yes.
So why aren't you choosing option A? Seriously.
Well, it isn't free because we still have to make the capital investment.
Yes.
And that has to be paid for. And our customers, or if Joel is doing the capital investment, our customers pay Joel through the rates that we pay Joel. If we make the investment, they pay us for the investment we make. So it's not free. It's just low cost after the initial capital investment.
And Mike, let me say, I mean, Duke's been here a long time, and they started off as a renewable energy company, you know, really with hydroelectricity, but they maintain the grid. And you know, for us to attract manufacturers or businesses, they need to know they have reliable power, they need to know that it's safe power, and they need to know it's affordable. And Duke's done a great job at doing that. And there needs to be continued investment, not only to maintain what we have, but, you know, Duke has a whole division called Smart Grid, you know, and how do we handle these new renewables? How do we handle storage? How do we continue to make our grid more reliable? And so that's never going to go away. Energy is always going to cost something. Even with solar, one of our biggest costs is maintaining the grass, mowing the grass, making sure it doesn't shade the panels. And, you know, we work with local farmers and we use sheep to minimize that cost. But that's a cost, you know, that's always going to be there. So no matter what source you have, you got to maintain the grid. You got to maintain your
Mike,
your
another
asset.
Another thing here, big picture. Let's say you have a really nice car that you've been driving for a while and you have a loan on it and you decide, gosh, I really want to get an electric car. I don't want to pay gas anymore. You can't just decide to stop using the old one and get a new car. You got to buy the new car. But you've also got that loan on the old one. And so retiring the old equipment, if my analogy works, retiring the old equipment, getting rid of that old infrastructure, it can't happen overnight. It has to happen in a careful way, and Duke Energy plans these things out for decades in advance.
Dustin.
And one of the things that's left out of the conversation now about the investments utilities make are the hidden costs that are borne by the tax holders or taxpayers. And so we do have the cost of burning fossil fuels has huge health impacts, mm-hmm. has environmental impacts. It uses our roads infrastructure and needs repaving. So there are all these hidden costs that Duke Energy doesn't bear, but the taxpayers do. And those don't get factored into rates. So when you're talking about the overall cost, the impacts on our environment and public health, I think the cost of fossil fuels is way greater than a lot of us think.
Well, you've got the coal ash ponds that we're dealing Indeed. With now, you mentioned the paving of the roads. People don't realize that these coal trucks and these big trucks that move all this stuff in and out of these plants use the roads, and that's a public subsidy. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. And
what about the environmental concerns over solar? There are people who say that these solar farms, in order to keep the grass under control, use a lot of pesticides that are harmful to the environment, and that these wind farms are detrimental to, I don't know why, but to birds. And maybe that's a concern for a lot of people. What about that?
Yeah, you know, I think every sort of energy generation they need to be properly cited. So there are numerous studies, environmental impact statements that are done to make sure that there's going to be a little impact on the environment as possible when building a wind farm or solar array. And I think Joel is right. The folks who get into clean energy are going to be a little more conscious about the impact that's going to have on the environment. And so I think the pesticides use is a concern, but, you know, Joel uses sheep. And with wind farms, what we're seeing now is we're generating more electricity, and we can do so in ways that do not interfere with migratory bird patterns, and that's very helpful as well.
If I understood some of your reporting on this, David, correctly, one of the concerns is that if we move too quickly into these alternative forms of energy, Duke Energy is particularly worried that the costs will go up. Is that what I understood? Is that true?
That's sort of what I was getting at before. I mean, the utility is under the rule of law, mm-hmm. and we have to be – they're regulated by the state, and the state carefully watches rates. Everything Duke does, every capital investment that they make, Duke has a right to come and say we'd like to get paid for that. And if they do too much too fast, the regulators might be the ones that say we don't want to do this. There are also people who are very concerned that, you know, their rates for them are – kind of pricey right now. You mentioned that we're the lowest in you know, one of the lowest states for energy prices. But for some people, you know, that monthly bill to Duke Energy is a big deal. And
yes.
So that's another one of those things that we can't just willy-nilly change this overnight and expect everybody to go for it. Now, there are surveys that say, you know, people will tell you, I'd be willing to pay another $20 a month if I could get all of my electricity from solar and or from renewable sources. And I think that's important yeah. information, but there are people for whom that decision is not so easy.
Let me ask the two people involved in the industry itself, Joel Olson with O2 Energies and George Brown from Duke. Is the steady stream of technological improvement a detriment to moving forward more quickly? Because it seems to me like anything today that's technological, if you buy it today, the $4,000 television that you see at Best Buy next year will be $2,000 or $1,000. So does that make you hold off? Because why buy it now? It'll be cheaper next year, but next year there'll be another $4,000 that'll be better than the one you're going to get for $2,000. What does that do to you?
Well, Mike, I think you have to remember the product that we're selling is kilowatt hours. That's the power.
Yeah, but you have to buy the equipment.
Itself, absolutely. And whether O2 or Duke makes an investment, they make an investment in an asset that will last somewhere around 35 years at least. Mm-hmm. And so you're amortizing that cost over 35 years. That gives us a very good kind of baseline in terms of how can we match the cost we have today and lower that continuously. When you look at the technology itself, yes, technology is not only getting cheaper, but I think we're approaching the iPhone of energy where we're getting better inverters, you know, more efficient equipment.
What's an inverter?
I'm sorry. An inverter, you know, there are many pieces to the electrical grid itself.
Right.
The inverter on the solar side converts the DC electricity
to
the
AC.
Solar generates to AC, which
okay.
is what we use on the grid.
Okay.
But the inverters provide a lot of benefits to controlling, for example, the frequency of the voltage or the voltage that we have on the grid. Sometimes, you know, if the voltage sags, lights dim, or, you know, they might brighten. And so having these distributed inverters on all these solar farms provide a brand new possibility to really provide better power quality than we've had before, but we're not using that yet.
But let's go back to the question I asked, and that is, do you really want to put a lot of money into solar array A when next year, right around the corner, solar array B is going to be better at the same price?
Well, I think that the way we do it makes sense in that every year we take a look at what we need, what new generation we need, and we compare the costs. And we make a decision based at that point in time on how much we need and what the relative costs are. And I think that continuous process is going to end up with more solar over time. But you're right, Mike. I wouldn't recommend that we suddenly go out and decide to do 10,000 megawatts of solar today.
And these solar farms, as you pointed out, David, take up a lot of land space. People are worried about that. But you say, and have you said it this morning, I believe, that there's an abundance of, and I'm going to use your word here, cheap farmland that could be used for solar farms. Where? And if that's true, if I'm a farmer and I have cheap land to sell and I see Duke Energy coming in or some of these other solar companies coming in, am I not automatically going to raise the price of that land? Because this is Duke Energy we're talking about here. They got plenty of money.
If somebody's interested in your farm and they want to put a solar array there, you're going to charge whatever you can get for it, but if they can go down the street and find another one. I mean, for some of these cases, each one of these is a business model for the investors, and they're going to get the best price they can. So there's a negotiation there.
And aren't they in competition? As you move toward more urban areas like Charlotte, aren't you in competition for land from developers, from home builders and places, people like that? Isn't that competition going to jack the price of the land up?
Yeah, and Mike, it's a good point. I think the thing to remember, though, is the amount of land that solar uses as part of our entire acreage we have in the state is something like 0.0006%. So it's inconsequential, but it could get bigger. The thing that's important is that, you know, we took a farm that was it wasn't even a farm, it was a hunting preserve that was never used for agriculture because the quality of soil was so bad, mm-hmm. and we turned that into 200 acres of pasture land where now sheep graze. Every single farm that we have, we are preserving, and in many instances, we're creating new farmland. And it makes financial sense for us to work with agriculture. And when, like you mentioned, there are competition with housing developments, which may never revert to farmland. Wind and solar, you know, not only can we revert to it, we can do it simultaneously while we generate clean energy.
Dustin.
And Mike, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, well, one of the things most companies actually lease the land from farmers, who for farmlands that have had struggling keeping up with, you know, growing crops, this allows them to make use of that land, keep it in the family, and preserve it for future generations. Huh. And it also generates taxable income and revenue for local counties. And that revenue isn't going to be used for services like sending kids to school because you're not building homes on it and you don't need to run water lines to it. So it generates a lot of revenue for local governments and creates a little burden for them.
David.
I think another problem for people who are citing renewable energy facilities is not in my backyard. We've seen some of that already. Covered a case a couple of years ago on Lake Norman where some folks that live in a residential development on the lake opposed development of a solar farm right next door to them. And this was a farm that was, you know, not anything special. They just didn't want the solar array there. And then there's this lawsuit that was filed against Amazon for the big wind farm that they're building out in eastern North Carolina, which recently was settled in Amazon's favor, right. Which allows it to go forward.
So. Let's talk about wind because we haven't really talked about wind very much. North Carolina is an ideal location, geographically speaking, for wind power. We have more potential for wind power than any other state on the Atlantic coast. And in fact, just a fraction of the winds off our shores used to produce energy could provide all of North Carolina's energy needs. Given that, why haven't we done more to take advantage of that power?
Well, one thing with offshore wind is still, I would say, in the United States, a largely nascent industry.
And because?
Because it's very expensive to construct the facilities and connect them back to the mainland. Because you've got to build lines that are able to handle the water and the corrosion of the water to be able to bring the energy back, and that's very expensive. Onshore wind is much more inexpensive, and we see a lot of that in the United States, not in North Carolina.
But we've had transatlantic telephone cables for 150 years. So if they can do it with telephone in the late 1800s, why can't we do it with electricity in the 21st
century? Well, I think, again, it's a relative cost thing. I think that, yes, you can do it, but the relative cost of that technology is high compared to other technologies such as land-based solar.
But that's changing. So the first large-scale offshore wind facility in the United States is being built now off of Block Island in Rhode Island. It's going to be coming online, and they've had historically high energy prices because they've been using mostly oil. And you're absolutely right. We do have the greatest potential on the East Coast, and we are in the process now where the federal government, since these are federal waters, is starting a leasing program. And so hopefully within the next few years, we're going to start seeing competitive bids moving us in that direction.
An organization called Conservatives for Clean Energy commissioned a poll of 800 voters in April that shows overwhelming support of both Republicans and Democratic voters for renewable energy in North Carolina. 88% supported new energy efficiency financing. 87% supported renewable energy. Only 48% support offshore drilling for gas and oil. 42% for new nuclear, and 30% for fracking for natural gas. And yet, there seems to be more of a push toward fracking and offshore drilling by politicians than for renewable sources. Why?
Well, this goes back to the issue. We've got
30 seconds.
We've got infrastructure in place. We've got businesses in place that have a vested interest in maintaining what they have. And I think that's what we've got.
We don't have fracking yet. So
we
that's
have
not
fracking.
To a small degree. We also have solar to a small degree. So why is fracking more politically popular when the people want something else?
Again, you know, that's fracking is producing gas for the gas-fired power plants, and we have those. So there's a market for it.
David Borax from WFAE News, Dustin Chickerell Baird from the Sierra Club, Joel Olson from O2 Energies, and George Brown with Duke Energy. Thank you all for the hour.